The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show, end of the week, and happy to have you with us. You can follow the show, danproftshow.com. Get podcast the program there as well as you can on Spotify and iTunes and all the usual places on social media at Dan Proft Show. And we begin tonight as we have the last several in my sweet home Chicago, not so sweet, still home. As under the cover of darkness in the early morning hours this morning, Mayor Triple Threat, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot, ordered the Christopher Columbus statue in the center of Grant Park, which is a big park right along the lake in Chicago. I'm sure many of you know who visited if you don't live here. That was the site of the protesting over the weekend where rioters were throwing projectiles and fireworks and other more disgusting, in addition to dangerous, objects at police, injuring dozens of police officers. One police sergeant may lose his sight as a result of being struck. Number of arrests. The rioters had attempted to pull down the Christopher Columbus statue initially. That's when police interceded. And as one friend of mine who lives right down by Grant Park, this area of Grant Park, said, it was the biggest police presence he's ever seen in Grant Park, and he's lived here for two decades. So after that happened and all those police were injured defending this monument and the rule of law, this is not, you want to remove a statue or erect one, this is not how you do it, by mob action. Well, not a week goes by, and with the prospect of more Antifa action in Chicago this weekend, Mayor Lightfoot orders the monument taken down. And subsequently declares peace in our time. Little Neville Chamberlain reference there, but that's the appeasement strategy of the socialist big city mayor, is it not? It is. And she is an appeaser. The tougher they talk, and the more they appease. Because they want to buffalo you with tough talk while they give in to the mob and to the anarchists and to a suspension of the rule of law, at least for the politically important. And that's what's happened in Chicago. It's been happening in Chicago for some time. I mean, to be fair to Mayor Lightfoot, this is a precedent that was set by Mayor Richie Daley almost two decades ago in 2003 when, not because of anything political other than a spat with the governor, an early governor, a governor from the 90s, Jim Egger, Daley wanted Migs Field, this general aviation airport right in the lake, he wanted it closed to make it park space. And this was a battle between the city and the state for some time. So in the cover of darkness in 2003, Daley sent out backhoes and X'd out the runway of Migs Field, effectively shuttering that field. That was a violation of federal law, FAA governed. It's a general aviation airport. No consequences. This is a violation of the law, what Lori Lightfoot did in ordering this monument down, because the Chicago Park District controls the parks. And while she can make appointments to the Park District Board, it is the Park District government's responsibility. It is under their authority that decisions about things like taking down a statue are made. Well, she did a bit of an end run because, as I said, the rule of law is suspended based on mayoral whim, or if it's not the mayor we're talking about, the political importance of the person or party in question. And the great irony of Chicagoans who still don't get it. So many around the country who don't get it. Otherwise, common sense people who can't believe what's happening before their very eyes, even though it's been afoot in all of these cities, Portland, Seattle, Detroit, Atlanta, San Francisco, L.A., New York, Chicago, this has all been afoot for generations. The willful suspension of disbelief is almost as tiresome as the tough talk from politicians. Listen to one spokesman for an Italian-American organization after this weekend's rioting, after the attempt by the Jacobins to take down the Columbus statue. This is what they thought was going to happen. Aren't they naive?
And if the elected officials, the mayor Lightfoot, and the city council has the vote to get rid of these Columbus statues, then they're going to have to address, then they're going to have to deal with the Italian-Americans. Because we have elected officials, too.
Do you? Do you have elected officials, too? Yeah. They're going to have to deal with the Italian-Americans. Oh, okay. You just got dealt with. Where were your elected officials? Italian-Americans, you're not a protected class. You're not interesting. You're not politically salient. We have a vote. What are you talking about? We don't need no vote. We don't need no stinking vote. Excuse my paraphrasing from the treasurer of Sierra Madre there. And so vote didn't happen. And this was after President Trump said he had a good conversation with Lori Lightfoot the other day. President Trump on Sean Hannity's program yesterday.
I spoke with the mayor of Chicago, Mayor Lightfoot, and had a great talk. But within minutes after that talk, you just reported it tonight, a couple of more people were shot. Young, very young children were shot.
Sad. So sad.
And it's a shame. It's a shame. And we could solve it. If they invited us in, we'd go in with 50,000, 75,000 people. We would be able to solve it like you wouldn't believe and quick. But they just don't want to ask, maybe for political reasons, but they don't want to ask. It's a disgrace.
Yeah, it's also not fundamentally a manpower problem. It's fundamentally a rules of engagement slash culture problem. So you can bring, I mean, right, ostensibly, if you're talking about 50, 75,000, the president's clearly talking about federal troops, not just law enforcement officers, to aid and assist the local authorities working under the auspices of the U.S. attorney. But you can bring in more manpower if the manpower is saddled under the same rules of engagement that the Chicago police are. Then you just have more people standing around watching the city burn and people victimized by violence, don't you? Yeah, you do, unfortunately. That's why something else the president had said, his announcement the other day, the expansion of Operation Legend to include Chicago and more federal agents dispatched to Chicago, about this fundamentally being a local law enforcement issue, fundamentally a local political issue. You have to deal with your civilian political authorities and your police department, and you got to make your own decisions. The federal government is here to support. The federal government is here to enforce federal law. It is my constitutional duty to enforce federal law, argued the president properly. But ultimately, if you don't want to hold your local officials accountable, if you don't want your neighborhoods to be policed and safe, then there's only so much the federal government can do about it. I mean, if you want to run off screaming, if you want to run screaming off a cliff, there's only so much that any person can do to persuade you, restrain you from doing so, if you're that intent on harming yourself. And some of these big cities and, well, a significant portion of their population is intent on doing that and has properly or effectively imposed fear on a large portion of the population that isn't game for running screaming off a cliff. By the way, if you think that Lori Lightfoot taking down the Columbus statue in Grand Park, if that buys her some street cred with the Jacobins, that, you know, they'll release the pressure on her, take their foot off the gas a little bit. Well, there were 1,000 people outside her home, a la what happened to Libby Schaff in Oakland earlier in the week. 1,000 people out protesting outside Lori Lightfoot's home. That's not good enough. You know, we appreciate your appeasement on the statues. We appreciate you giving us that victory. But appeasement's provocative, Mayor. I know as somebody who's never been an executive in any position, you don't appreciate that. Somebody that's groping in the dark, you don't appreciate it, but it is. So you got a lot more to do.
They're trying to tell us that more police are needed to address intercommunal violence? It is a lie! It is a lie! Chicago has the most police for any big city in this country!
And that was arguing for defunding the police. The mob had assembled outside Lori Lightfoot's home, protected by police, of course, to demand defunding of the police. So you're going to bend the knee yet again, Mayor? I mean, what else can you do when you start appeasing? It's hard to stop, isn't it, when you set that precedent? Oh, and by the way, as to all the statues and pieces of art, murals around the city, now we're, it was announced today by the mayor that she's going to put together a committee of the best and brightest, the betters in Chicago, these high-minded civic leaders, to determine which statues should stay and which should go. Can't wait for those recommendations. Oh, sure. You know, don't just the easy ones. Yeah, of course, Lincoln has to go. Ulysses says, land of Lincoln, by the way, state motto, right? Lincoln has to go. Grant has to go. Shakespeare has to go. The Tin Man in Lincoln Park, he doesn't have a heart, so he's got to go. I understand that. What about the Picassos and the other works of art around the city? We're going to find out. Maybe it's better that we just have empty pedestals around the city, the same way that the Washington football team doesn't have a nickname. This is Dan Prof. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Listen to podcast of the show at danprofshow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. We profiled this gentleman earlier in the week because he had a front seat view to some Black Lives Matter protesting, which is really a bunch of snot-nosed white kids disrupting people trying to enjoy a meal at a restaurant in Dallas. His name is Damani Felder, and he's the founder of this popular YouTube program, The Wright Brothers. And He said something in providing the commentary as he was filming what was going on so the rest of America could see it that I really liked, picked up on. I think Trump could actually use to frame the messaging for the duration of the campaign. Listen.
Because they could not behave and handle themselves appropriately. And now they're throwing stuff. This is the anarchy that they want. This is what they continue to do. Listen to it. Now we're breaking windows.
This is what they want. This is what they continue to do. And think about the visuals. This is what they want. And you have visuals like Mr. Felder documented at that Dallas restaurant. This is what they want. And this is what I want for you, America. Or this is what they want. Is this what you want? Ask the question open-ended. I think it's a great conversation starter. And it's great political messaging. This is what they want. Is a simple insight. It's t-shirtable. I'm going to trademark it before he does so I can make all the money off of Damani Felder's insight. Damani Felder, founder of YouTube's The Wright Brothers, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
When you said this is what they want as you were filming what was happening at that Dallas restaurant, what did you mean?
What I meant was they want to continue to foment this social unrest and this social anarchy. When these protesters were out here in Dallas recently, they actually came to this restaurant and they interrupted and effectively shut down a black jazz band that was performing live music. We had people of all races, all nationalities, all ages who were out there enjoying a peaceful, beautiful evening. And that wasn't enough for them. They wanted to ruin an otherwise peaceful evening just because they wanted us to have to suffer for whatever happened with George Floyd. We're talking more than six weeks ago at this point. So it's just very disconcerting, especially seeing the way they were willing to comport themselves around young black children. There were black families who were there at this restaurant as well, who were patrons, and their night was ruined as well. So the question really begs the question, what was the point of that if all they wanted to do was shut down the entire establishment?
It seems to me it's pretty simple what they want. They want power. And power is open-ended, and it comes in a lot of different forms. And they figured out that the claim they lay to obtain power, whether it's financial or political, is victimization. And they find that you have big city mayors and other elected officials that will relent, that will appease in the face of that in the face of those claims on that basis.
Well, you know, Black Lives Matter as an entity actually is a contradictory and disingenuous organization, because if Black lives did matter, they would be just as incensed when any innocent Black life was taken. As we saw in Chicago, there was a funeral home ambush that had 14 people shot just a couple days ago. And they don't want to go out in the streets and riot or protest for that reason, even though there are plenty of innocent people who were caught in the crossfire there. It really goes to show their true motive. It's not about Black lives. This is just about fomenting unrest. This is just about basically getting an excuse to go out and act however you would like to whenever you think you have the slightest reason or rationale to do so.
So how are you received by you know, fellow cohorts in your age group in the Black community when you say the things that you say, like you documented that Dallas restaurant like you do in your YouTube videos? What's the reaction?
It's still somewhat of a mixed bag, because unfortunately the hive-minded mentality has taken hold in the African-American community. I do get a fair amount of vitriol, but I also get certain people who are willing to start questioning that narrative, because people are starting to see Black Lives Matter for what it really is. And it was really, the veil has come off, and Black Lives Matter is just another wing of the Democrat Party that has continued to throw effectively a 4-year-long temper tantrum over the election of President Donald Trump. So the way they're acting, the way, you know, they in Antifa and the Democrat Party is acting, really is just, it's very disheartening to see that they just cannot accept the results of the election, and they're willing to do anything in their power to wrest control away from President Trump, which he's actually done more than many other presidents in the past, to actually reach out and try to demonstrate how much he wants to help the African-American community.
How did you receive Joe Biden's statement the other day in response to President Trump's Operation Legend expansion to other cities beyond Kansas City, including Chicago? Where Biden said, you know, this is the first racist to be elected president of the United States. I took that as, and Bobby Rush, a congressman from Chicago, saying that Trump is auditioning to be the Grand Wizard of the KKK. I took that to mean that they're very worried about Trump getting a percentage of the Black vote on November 3rd that makes it impossible for Joe Biden to win, impossible for the Democrats to take control of the Senate, that, you know, he may be, it's, you know, from 8% in 2016 to 11, 12, 13%. And if he gets double digits of the Black vote, that presents a real problem for them. What's happening in big cities is can't be sitting well with a whole lot of Black families who are subjected to this violence and to this unrest. Even if they, you know, support police reform and other issues, they still don't want lawlessness in their neighborhoods. They don't want their children jeopardized. And President Trump being law and order on this issue, as opposed to what those Democrats are offering, that's a real opportunity. They can't let people focus on what's happening in the cities, so they have to say, all you need to know is that Trump is a racist.
Exactly. It's a dumbing down of the rhetoric, but also an escalation of the rhetoric. And that escalation can be directly correlated to the panic that's setting in for the Democratic Party. For the last 4 years now, we've heard them vilify anyone who is an old white man as being inherently the worst of the worst. And then out of all the candidates they had run in the primary, they nominated an old white man, Joe Biden, to run against President Trump. Joe Biden, who was on record saying that he didn't want his kids growing up in a racial jungle. You want to talk about someone who was auditioning to be the first, you know, the Grand Wizard of the KKK. That was actually one of Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden's allies, Robert Byrd, who was a Grand Wizard of the KKK and who Joe Biden had nothing but good things to say about. So seeing how hypocritical the left really is becoming with their rhetoric, and also seeing how little they think of the average American who really does have all this information that I just mentioned available on their smartphones themselves, but who apparently would rather take what the Democrat Party is selling than investigate and do their own research to find out who the real racists are, because the real racists are demonstrably and incontrovertibly the Democratic Party.
He is Damani Felder. He is the founder of YouTube's popular program, The Wright Brothers. Damani, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time and insights.
Thanks for having me.
Just about the time to think it, it's all right. Break down, take down.
listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. Yesterday, the CDC released various virtual tools and guidelines toward assisting schools and educational staff around the country as in-person classes are set to resume, as they're set to resume in some places and not so much in others. It's critically important for our public health to open schools this fall, said CDC Director Robert Redfield. The CDC resources released today will help parents, teachers, and so forth. But the position couldn't be clear. It's important for them to reopen. And by reopen, we mean in-person education. That's the discussion. And the science on this is overwhelming. British epidemiologist and a member of the government's SAGE committee telling The Times, his name Mark Woolhouse. There's increasing evidence that kids rarely transmit. For example, it is extremely difficult to find any instance anywhere in the world as a single example of a child transmitting to a teacher in school. There may have been one in Australia, but it's incredibly rare. And so much of the defense for not reopening is because kids can transmit to adults and then adults take it home to their families and so on and so forth. But that runs into what Mark Woolhouse is saying about transmission and, frankly, what we know about transmission from some other real-world studies, like the studies done by the public health departments in both Sweden and Finland of both student infections as well as student transmission. And then you have this, a bunch of Harvard public health officials. This is so great. This just speaks to how overwhelming it is, actually. A bunch of Harvard public health officials essentially take the position, don't listen to Trump. The topic is, should schools reopen? Do not listen to Trump is what they say. Listen to the science and reopen schools. They go through the science. Prolonged time away from schools has led to months of lost learning and widened gaps in educational achievement, especially for students of color and lower income households. Multiple studies show children are not only less likely to become seriously ill, they're also only half as likely to get infected in the first place. What about risk to teachers and staff? Again, listen to the science. A report led by CDC under President Obama concluded children appear less likely than adults to transmit COVID-19 to others, though this evidence is still limited and preliminary. What about the impacts on community as a whole? Studies show social distancing measures have been critical to flattening the curve, but school closures may be among the least effective of those measures. So ignore Trump, because we don't want to be seen as allied with Trump. But just pay attention to the science and these Harvard public health officials, four of them, all professors, Harvard School of Public Health. Listen to the science and open the schools. So the teachers' unions are sort of left naked and they should be afraid, shouldn't they? That it will become obvious to those for whom it's not obvious now that the teachers' unions just don't want to go back. You have to be willfully blind to not know everything that we are discussing. If it's so accessible to us on this radio program, then it's equally accessible to teachers' union bosses and rank-and-file teachers the world over. This is not a secret. No, teachers are not in the position of doctors in March. They are not. That's nice cover for them, but I'm sorry they're not. No one is who has an iota of intellectual curiosity. This is, yes, people that are fear-addled and anxiety riddled because of politicians and the politicians that run their unions. But there is no defense on the merits to the position of keeping schools closed, I would argue, and others have, although there's some who still disagree, want to, you know, err on the abundance of caution because they have tunnel vision, including people we respect, I respect, like Dr. Henry Miller out of the Pacific Research Institute, very middling on the issue. It's remarkable. But, I mean, the science is just overwhelming from across the, you know, political spectrum because everything has been so politicized here. All right, when we come back, we'll be joined by Dr. Waqar Rashid, consultant neurologist at St. George University's Foundation Hospital NHS Trust in London.
You gotta fight for your right to party. Your pops call you smoking, man. He says, no way. That hypocrite smokes two packs a day. Man, living at home is such a drag.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back. We're now pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Dr. Waqar Rashid, consultant neurologist at St. George University's Foundation Hospital, NHS Trust in London. Dr. Rashid, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We spoke with Dr. John Lee, a retired pathologist across the pond there with you in England earlier in the week. And, you know, he takes the same position that I just articulated, which is on the substance, on the merits, on the science, kids should be back in school. Is that your position?
Yes, I couldn't agree more. I personally think it was a questionable decision to close schools, certainly in the UK, and I certainly want children to be back at school as soon as possible. As you know, your piece just now has said, the evidence of risk is extremely low. We can never live in an absolute risk-free environment, but, you know, on the balance of the benefit of having children in school and the safety aspects, there's an overwhelming case for schools to be reopened.
A professor at a university genetics institute in London, Professor Francois Ballot, tweeted the following. I believe the these two statements below are equally valid. One, letting COVID-19 infect the whole population is morally unacceptable. Two, the measures that would be required to suppress COVID-19 globally are morally unacceptable. As such, I'm afraid there's no solution, only trade-offs. Yes, that seems rather pedestrian, except, I guess, in the West in 2020, that we live in a world of trade-offs, not perfect solutions, not the complete insulation from risk, not only benefits without any costs. But that's positively revolutionary compared to what we're hearing from so many public health officials and doctors and thus the politicians around the world, particularly in the West. I mean, if that would have been the framing of this from the beginning consistently, don't you think would have gotten to more balanced, measured, thoughtful public policy decisions?
Yeah, I agree with the quotes you've given me. I think there's been a very minimalistic argument, really, about, and certainly in the UK, it's all been about, you know, surges and waves and tsunamis of infection and, you know, very tragically, many people dying. But, you know, life and the issue is filled with complexity. And for anyone to, I think, pretend and suggest that with measures, whether it be lockdown or whatever you want to do, that you can tell this virus to go away, they're not being honest. You know, you can't indefinitely hide from a virus. And what you need to do is then to try and mitigate against its effects. And that is by developing strategies to improve the treatment and looking at prevention strategies and trying to protect those most vulnerable. And, you know, you have to have, I think, an honest and grown-up conversation with people and say, look, this is coming. This is something we've not had to face before. We can't take this away and remove risk completely, but we will do these strategies for these reasons to try and minimize its effect, with the aim then, as soon as it is feasible, to return back to a normality of life.
Let's talk about vaccines for a moment. The president and many others are very optimistic about a vaccine based on some of the early returns from the Oxford AstraZeneca group, as well as per a deal that the U.S. federal government's struck with Pfizer and BioNTech for 100 million doses of their potential vaccine, $2 billion deal. Bill Gates, the billionaire, on with Norah O'Donnell this week on CBS, said that it could take an unbelievably big number of doses to beat the virus. None of the vaccines at this point appear like they'll work with a single dose, which was the hope from the beginning. There's still a lot of uncertainty, and because of that uncertainty about the vaccine and the number of doses required to effectively vaccinate significant swaths of the populations across the world, that it's likely that school won't resume in-person classes, generally speaking, until the fall of 2021.
Yeah, it's again about balancing with risk. So in terms of the first point you make about vaccines, this is really a completely new area. There's never been developed before a vaccine for a coronavirus. And so coronaviruses in different forms have been around for many, many years. About 20% of the common cold are coronaviruses. So we've never been able, as a scientific body, to develop a vaccine to coronaviruses. There are several challenges with developing a vaccine to a virus in terms of viruses' ability to change form, shape, how it, and defense mechanisms that it may have. I've been absolutely astonished by the initial progress that has been made by whether it be in Oxford or the BioNTech Pfizer, there's one or two others, Moderna as well. So I've been amazed by how quickly the initial testing has taken place, but the bigger challenges still are to come in terms of the wider testing of efficacy. All that's really happened to date is looking at how tolerable or safe over a short period of time amongst healthy people these vaccines are. There's been, you know, some positive noises that the vaccines can stimulate a response from our body, which is an absolute prerequisite for any vaccine. But as you say, there is uncertainty as to how much of a response, is it going to be sufficient, and is it going to be long-lasting enough to give us protection? And again, coming to your second point about, returning to school, 2021, It's saying to people that we cannot do normal things without there being a risk-free environment. And I don't think we've ever lived life like that before. We've always had to take on board some element of risk in our lives. And, so it seems to me that the paradigm has really been shifted here to something, a balance of risk that has never been there before. And I find it very difficult to understand that logic.
He is Dr. Waqar Rashid. He's a consultant neurologist at St. George's University Foundation Hospital, NHS Trust in London. Dr. Rashid, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back. Speaking of responsibility in the COVID era, didn't want to have Dr. Rashid tackle this topic. Thought I'd tackle it on my own. I think you'll find I exercise good restraint on that score. A Texas jiggle joint has found a creative way to attract customers while still letting their ladies strut their stuff during the COVID-19 outbreak, drive-through strip club. This comes to us from the New York Post. Vivid Gentlemen's Club in Houston. Don't you love that these joints are called Gentlemen's Club? Anyway, set up inside a makeshift tent turned club where customers can park for just two songs. and enjoy the entertainment. Uh-huh. Drivers can also order food from the joint's menu, including nachos, burgers, jalapeno poppers. Sure. Nice night out. And an authentic Italian pizza that's somehow handmade in Italy, according to the menu. I don't like the term handmade on a menu at a strip joint, but that's me. Customers can also order booze and pick from several types of six packs or even an entire bottle of Fireball. That's good. Good to down a burger and a bottle of Fireball before, and two songs, so maybe 10 minutes before you get back on the road. This is well conceived. Houston, not the first city for innovation from the adult entertainment industry. Portland, Oregon, I suppose this is Antifa / Ted Wheeler approved. A strip club there named Lucky Devil Lounge brought their show to the curb for drivers back in May. Real pioneers. Also, New York City, one seemingly impromptu party in a parking lot appeared to have at least one stripper, although I'm not sure if that was an actual business enterprise or just the nature of partying in New York during COVID-19 as the city has depopulated and there's nobody there except the wraiths and the ne'er-do-wells of the night, as Dan Hanninger referenced in his column in the Wall Street Journal this week that we mentioned yesterday. You think that's a bit uncomfortable. Well, you haven't seen what Canada's top health experts have advanced in terms of recommendations for Canadians for sex during COVID. Remember, we went through the guidelines right at the outset of the outbreak. The New York City Public Health Department issued some very graphic recommendations. Well, I'm not going to get into a lot of the details about how you should wash sex toys per the British Columbia Center for Disease Control, or how you should wash up after carnal relations, or the sexual positions you should choose, or the protective gear that you should don. I'm not going to get into that. And I'm certainly not going to get into their reference to glory holes. I will not get into that because I'm a gentleman and not the kind that would go to a gentleman's club, I may add. This is Dan Prof.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Prof Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to another edition of the Dan Proft Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow us, danproftshow.com. That is the website. You also find podcasts there, as you do on Spotify and iTunes. Twitter at Dan Proft and at Dan Proft Show. On Tuesday, I believe it was, you had a Oval Office briefing in which Secretary of Treasury Steve Mnuchin outlined the administration's priorities for any sort of phase four relief legislation, which included things like a payroll tax cut and liability protection. And then 48 hours later, the payroll tax cut and just about anything resembling growth-oriented policy was gone. And in its place was a watered-down version of what Nancy Pelosi and Democrat socialists in the House had advanced as part of their $3 trillion gambit. Writing in the Wall Street Journal, Kim Strassel, who needs Nancy Pelosi demanding more spending, more unemployment benefits, and more union payoffs when Steve Mnuchin and Mitch McConnell will do it for her? 5 months after the coronavirus's arrival, Washington has settled into a predictable loop. Speaker Pelosi's House unveils sweeping virus legislation with vast dollar figures and progressive policy demands. Republicans argue among themselves. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin crashes in to negotiate the GOP back to their own five-yard line. Senator Majority Leader McConnell reminds his caucus it's an election year and provides Mrs. Pelosi her touchdown. America goes another $1 trillion or two into debt. The mystery, she adds, is why or who in the White House keeps deputizing Mnuchin as the lead congressional envoy, given Pelosi's flawless record at schooling him in the art of the deal. The Treasury Secretary remains relentlessly focused on what House Democrats want rather than on what the economy or the Trump White House actually needs. Yeah, clearly who's deputizing him is President Trump. He has had very positive things to say, and he's provided Mnuchin with a greatly increased profile throughout the course of the coronavirus response. And let me tell you something, putting another Goldman Sachs guy in charge of fiscal policy, that ain't draining the swamp. That's deepening it. And that's exactly what Strassel and the Wall Street Journal editorial board argues, as any free market oriented person or group would. And they're exactly right. For more on how this plays out politically and where President Trump is after saying just this past Sunday on Chris Wallace's show that if there's no payroll cut in the phase four, you know, I might be inclined to veto it. Well, that doesn't seem to be the actual position of the president and his administration. Joining us is Brett Baer, Fox News anchor, special report, 5 p.m. weekdays, Chicago time. Number one bestselling author of 3 Days at the Brink, FDR's Daring Gamble to Win World War II. So there's a lot of movement from President Trump and his team from Sunday to Tuesday to yesterday.
Yeah, I had White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows on last night, and I went down the line of what's not in there now. Payroll tax cut was the biggest, which, as you point out, the president said numerous times was very important to him. They gave up that fight once they realized that everybody on their side was not on the same page. The issue with Republicans always is that they don't fall in line like Democrats do with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. They don't get behind. They raise up and argue and kind of fight for things inside their own caucus. And once you can't speak as one with all of those votes, then you lose bargaining power, and they need to get this bill across the finish line. So they started punting. I agree with you that Mnuchin has a history here negotiating but capitulating to Nancy Pelosi.
You have Ron Johnson. I mean, speaking of the disagreement, you know, when their disagreement comes from members of the Senate who don't want to ham-handedly delve the United States another trillion or two into debt, that's sort of ignored. When they want to concede points that the Democrats demand be conceded, then there's agreement. So Ron Johnson, again, writing in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, no more blank checks from Congress for coronavirus. Why is Congress rushing to pass at least $1 trillion more in coronavirus relief? Why are Republicans again pressing for another round of checks being sent to the American people when we know that's not stimulative? We know that saving isn't the problem right now. What's the problem is the confidence to spend and the need to grow. And what is being proposed, what was passed by Pelosi and what's being proposed as sort of a middle way doesn't address those fundamentals.
Yeah, and the people who are for a payroll tax cut make a good argument that you can push a button and say it's not being collected. And so take that money, it goes right into the check, and it infuses the businesses, inspires them essentially to get workers back so that they can be a part of that. And the workers then see the money directly. So, you know, there's a good case to be made. Art Laffer makes it. Others make it. It was not made effectively on Capitol Hill.
The decision President Trump announced yesterday to cancel the Jacksonville portion of the convention. They're still going to, you know, do the perfunctory sort of back of the room stuff in North Carolina. But in terms of any public facing, there'll be some sort of different nomination speech that he makes. Was that really his decision to say just the optics are bad, particularly in Florida dealing with an increase in cases? Was he getting pressure from his own party, a combination of the two?
It was a combination. You started having delegates saying we can't go there. This spike, they're putting up Jacksonville numbers to all the RNC delegates. They keep on going up, and the deaths and the spike is going up right there where the convention would be. You can take all the mitigation efforts that you want, but if the virus, you know, the virus has a vote here, and it's voted that Jacksonville is not going to be able to do it. So the president made this decision. Meadows said that it was tough as a politician because you want to have this big launch, but it was easy, he claims, for the president, because I think he's more focused and laser focused on coronavirus as he looks at the polls and how much people are concerned about it.
Speaking of that, I mean, do you think that House Democrats or Senate Democrats or the Biden team have any concerns about the position they're essentially being forced into, opposing school reopenings in conjunction with their teachers union backers, and because President Trump is being so aggressive in promoting school reopening? Any danger about a backlash from middle of the road parents around America and middle income parents around America who the kids not being back in school or even being back in school only 2 days a week turns out to be a real problem for their lives in addition to the social and intellectual development of their children?
Yeah, and not only for the kids, but also for the U.S. economy. Listen, if you look at these polls and everybody focused on 8%, only 8% say they want the schools open. Well, it's something like 68% want the schools open with either minor adjustments or major adjustments to how it operates. I don't think that that's unreasonable, but you look at the poll differently if you add up all of those numbers. So you're close to 70% of American parents want their kids back to school with some mitigation efforts. And yeah, I think if you're on a strict no school open because that's where the teachers union is, potentially that's a political issue, but it should not be a political issue. We should figure out how to do it. And that's what every expert from Fauci to Birx will tell you, is that you can do it.
Before I let you go, I want to get your reaction as a member of the press corps to this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, going back to the Journal. The editorial board's response to the newsroom, essentially, at the Journal, which was very interesting. 280 Wall Street Journal colleagues signed a letter to the publisher criticizing the op-ed pages in the Journal. And they respond, not on point, but to say, look, the signers report to the news editors and other parts of the business, and the news and opinion departments operate with separate staffs and editors. It was probably inevitable that the wave of progressive cancel culture would arrive at the Journal, but we're not the New York Times. Most Journal reporters attempt to cover the news fairly and down the middle, and our opinion pages offer an alternative to the uniform progressive views that dominate nearly all of today's media. As long as our proprietors allow us the privilege to do so, the opinion pages will continue to publish contributors who speak their minds within the traditional, within the tradition of vigorous reason debate. Simpler times, that would be sort of a pro forma, perfunctory, uneventful statement. Today, it's a positively clarion call for the Fourth Estate and for, you know, free thinking and free speaking in a free America. And I just want to get your reaction to, the spat inside the house at the Journal.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the cancel culture, if it had its way, would like to see Fox off the air. We do the same thing. We have a news division and we have an opinion division, and we work under the same umbrella, but we do two different, very different things. And, I cover the news so that, you know, the opinion folks do what they do, Sean and Tucker and Laura. So it's the same kind of dynamic. And we as a country should welcome different voices. And that's what we're all about, is the ability to put things out there, talk about it, and kind of hash it out. And the news is the news. And the Wall Street Journal news people are great. And, you know, we're simpatico under the same company umbrella. But the opinion folks have to have their lane, and we will fight for that to happen.
He is Brett Baer, Fox News anchor, host of Special Report, best-selling author of 3 Days at the Brink, FDR's Daring Gamble to Win World War II. Brett, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Have a good weekend.
DanProfShow.com.
Welcome back to the show. Bookending serious discussions, the one we just had with Brett Baer, the one we're going to have with Isabel Taborowski from Tablet Magazine. I thought a little bit of leavening, have a less serious discussion about a wildly less serious person. That would be AOC, or End of the World Spice, as I call her. Remember the Socialist Spice Girls? You got your AOC, she's End of the World Spice. You got your Ayanna Pressley, she's Frances Parker Spice. That's the private, the hoity-toity private school she went to in Chicago. You got your Ilhan Omar, that's Brotherly Love Spice. I think that's self-explanatory for anybody who's followed Ilhan Omar and her various controversies. And then you got your Rashida Tlaib, who's MF-er Spice, because remember, we're going to take out this MF-er, referring to Trump. So those are your four Socialist Spice Girls, and hopefully their girl power will last about as long as the Spice Girls' girl power did. She took to the House floor to report on a dastardly incident This is the much yo-ho or yo-ho? Much yo-ho to do about nothing? How's that? Does that work? This is an allegation she made that Florida Congressman Ted Yoho made some derogatory remarks to her while they had a chance passing on the Capitol steps. And no, this is not a Capitol steps parody. AOC on the coarse words to which she was allegedly subjected and, you know, what they say about the larger culture and all the battles that she waged and continues to wage on behalf of her constituents and every single woman in America, the heroine that she is.
I was walking up the steps of the Capitol when Representative Yoho suddenly turned a corner, and he was accompanied by Representative Roger Williams, and accosted me on the steps right here in front of our nation's Capitol.
Oh, my gosh.
I was minding my own business, walking up the steps, and Representative Yoho put his finger in my face. He called me disgusting. He called me crazy. He called me out of my mind.
Yeah.
And he called me dangerous. And then he took a few more steps. And after I had recognized his comments as rude, he walked away and said, "I'm rude. You're calling me rude." I took a few steps ahead, and I walked inside and cast my vote because my constituents send me here each and every day to fight for them.
Yes.
And to make sure that they are able to keep a roof over their head, that they're able to feed their families, and that they're able to carry their lives with dignity. I walked back out, and there were reporters in the front of the Capitol, and in front of reporters, Representative Yoho called me, and I quote, "A f***ing bitch." These are the words that Representative Yoho levied against a congresswoman.
Oh, my goodness.
The congresswoman that not only represents New York's 14th congressional district, but every congresswoman and every woman in this country. Because all of us have had to deal with this in some form, some way, some shape, at some point in our lives. And I want to be clear that Representative Yoho's comments were not deeply hurtful or piercing to me because I have worked a working class job.
She's every woman. Yeah, not self-regarding very much is AOC. The comments allegedly, because you'll hear from Congressman Yoho momentarily, the comments allegedly directed at her, which would be very specific to her were they made, that she's dangerous, out of her mind, disgusting, harsh, off the mark. Those could be very limited to just speaking to AOC and no other woman on the planet, actually. I'm sure there are others that merit that description. But her cloaking herself as the simulacrum for every woman in the America is so preposterous. And the basis for it, because she worked a working class job as a waitress. What a heroine. And she's just there going to bat for her constituents because sans AOC representing the Bronx, no one in the Bronx would have a roof over their head, food on their table, or be able to live their life with dignity. Oh my, how dare you talk to a congressman like this? Oh yes, our elected officials shouldn't be addressed in the common vernacular of the plebeians, of the little people, master congresswoman, congressman, my liege AOC, or anybody else in Congress. Give me a break. Get over yourself. You're a temporary representative, and so is every other member of Congress. We could take or leave all 535 of you. Yeah. As my high school basketball coach used to say, the graveyards are full of indispensable people, and so are the political graveyards. Listening to her moralizing, I mean, she is disgusting, truly. And she is one of the dimmest bulbs in a place that features a lot of dim bulbs and the profile she has. It must be frustrating. But Congressman Yoho who then took to the House floor to offer an apology of sorts, suggests that what she says he said, he didn't say.
So let me take a moment to address this body. I rise to apologize for the abrupt manner of the conversation I had with my colleague from New York. It is true that we disagree on policies and visions for America, but that does not mean we should be disrespectful. Having been married for 45 years with two daughters, I'm very cognizant of my language. The offensive name-calling words attributed to me by the press were never spoken to my colleagues, and if they were construed that way, I apologize for their misunderstanding. As my colleagues know, I'm passionate about those affected by poverty. My wife Carolyn and I started out together at the age of 19 with nothing. We did odd jobs, and we were on food stamps. I know the face of poverty, and for a time it was mine. That is why I know people in this country can still, with all its faults, rise up and succeed and not be encouraged to break the law. I will commit to each of you that I will conduct myself from a place of passion and understanding, that policy and political disagreement be vigorously debated with the knowledge that we approach the problems facing our nation with the betterment of the country in mind and the people we serve. I cannot apologize for my passion or for loving my God, my family, and my country. I yield back.
Okay. I mean, you know, can any of these politicians just stay on point and answer a simple question? Did you say it or not? Or are you sorry for it or not? This apologize for loving my God and family. Nobody's asking you that. Can you just both sides just dispense with your, you know, Norman Rockwellian personal stories, how you overcame all the odds? It's fine. You know, a lot of people have tough lives. Big deal. I'm so tired of listening to it. Oh, the histrionics. She says you called her these names. She's upset about it while she's pretending not to be. Did you call those names? Do you care if she's upset about it? Do you want to apologize? Yes, no, or whatever, and be done with it, for goodness sakes. These are such silly people, aren't they? Silly people. And unfortunately, they have a lot of power to make decisions over lives being led in this country by people who aren't silly.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the show. Are Americans in this era of purging, as I've been describing on this show in some detail, including the story I told yesterday, and the stories we'll continue to tell, that I know the left and those promoting the purge and those who have folded in to the purge, to the mobs, suggesting that these stories are anomalous one-offs. They don't represent anything important culturally that's occurring. I disagree, even if you can count the number of those who've had their careers ended or reputations ruined irresponsibly, recklessly, unfairly in the hundreds or even just the thousands in a country of 330 million people. I mean, that is an infinitesimal problem, they would argue. And I would argue that it's not, that every one of those stories, every one of those incidents, every one of those examples creates reverberations throughout American culture to frighten exponentially more than may ever be touched by the purgers. They don't need to be touched. They'll self-censor. They'll comply preemptively. That's the point. And that's why it only takes making the example of the few to get compliance from the many. And so you have people living double lives, as was described in this very good piece that I remarked upon weeks back when it was first published in Tablet Magazine, The American Soviet Mentality. The double life. The life in which your public and private selves are very different. And the author of the piece, Isabella Taborowski, writes, "Those who join in the hounding, the purge, face their own hazards. The more loyalty you pledge to a group that expects you to participate in rituals of collective demonization, the more it will ask of you and the more you, too, will feel controlled. How much of your own autonomy as a thinking, feeling person are you willing to sacrifice to the collective? What inner compromises are you willing to make for the sake of being part of the group? Which personal relationships are you willing to give up?" She describes her feeling of America's culture at the moment as, quote, incredibly precarious, unquote. And I agree. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Isabella Taborowski, contributing writer at Tablet, researcher with the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, focusing on the politics of historical memory in the former Soviet Union. Historical memory, that seems to be a particularly salient topic area as well. Isabella, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, of course. And you start off your piece providing a very tangible and high-profile example of Soviet culture mid-20th century, and that was the villainization of famed author Boris Pasternak, who wrote Dr. Zhivago. Give us the backstory on what happened to him and why that is such a important example to underscore the larger point.
Sure. So Boris Pasternak was, of course, a prominent poet and a writer already in the 40s and early 50s. And then he wrote Dr. Zhivago, which the regime considered dangerous because it represented the system as something that was oppressing the individual and constraining the rights of the individual and bringing real pain and misery to people who were caught up in that system. Pasternak managed to publish the novel abroad. He couldn't do it inside the country. And for that, he was vilified, ostracized. There was an organized campaign against him, as I described in the piece. The entire literary establishment was involved in it. People who had been his colleagues and friends, admirers, students, all were drawn into this campaign. Some of the things that I wasn't able to include in the piece, but I think are important, is that students of the Literary Institute, for example, were specifically drawn to protest against him. And then the campaign really spread throughout the country, and more people were kind of expected to demonize him as well. This despite the fact that nobody actually read the novel, because the novel was prohibited. It had only been published abroad. And Pasternak was awarded the Nobel Prize, was selected for a Nobel Prize in Literature, and he initially accepted, but eventually was forced to say that he couldn't take it because of the reaction that he received inside the country. And it sounded, he made it sound, and I think that he truly felt it, that he didn't want to create sort of the pain and the grief that was producing in the country. Also, his family was being demonized and pressured. So I think that I chose that piece because it is so well known among the Russian people. And to me, it really illustrates a lot of the troubling trends we see here, specifically how people are being drawn into these campaigns. For example, signing letters against certain individuals.
Yeah, and I want to pick it up there when we come back, because I want to get to the symmetry you see between the Soviet culture during the Cold War and the American culture right now, with mobs running amok in American cities. More with Isabella Taborowski, contributing writer at Tablet and researcher with the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, right after this.
Seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. In a piece at Persuasion, this is a blog by Emily Yaffe, who's a contributing writer at The Atlantic. She talks about the taxonomy of fear, how essentially the purge works. And one of the features of it, if you apply sort of a construct to the approach, is safetyism, the idea that emotional discomfort equates with physical danger, that what you say can be akin to violence. In fact, what you don't say can also be synonymous with violence. And this is the opportunity for the government to intercede and start to regulate speech and thinking, because if speech and thinking become synonymous with violence, then the government will say, I have a duty to protect the citizens from the violence you're committing against them. Ideas that do not conform with the established orthodoxy. Want to pick it up there with Isabella Taborowski. We're speaking with contributing writer at Tablet, researcher with the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. And Isabella, that whole safetyism, silence is violence. I don't feel safe with the idea you're proposing. I need a safe space. You must provide a trigger warning before you offer a thought on a particular topic. Do those features of American culture today harken back to Soviet culture of a century ago?
Well, that's a good question. I think this specific iteration of all of it is perhaps it's uniquely American, and perhaps it's actually a signal that we, in fact, live in a society where, look, it's hard for me. I mean, I know that a lot of people do feel unsafe in many ways, but at the same time, back in the Soviet Union, look, my great-grandfather was arrested for having said four things over a period of like 8 months. A friend of his was reporting on him from within the discussions that he had within a circle of friends. He was no dissident. He was just a regular person, simple working class man. But over a period of a few months, the kind of the regime's policy changed. And all of a sudden, these four things, four sentences that he said became seditious. And they had been recorded and he was arrested. And then the family never saw him again. And then 15 years later, they got a note which said that he was innocent, which, of course, was too late. It makes me think of how today people dig through people's tweets and find some things that they said a long time ago. And literally, this was kind of a premise behind a letter, a collective letter against Steven Pinker. The thing is, back in the Soviet Union, people faced true danger when certain things were said. In this society, I don't know, is it really danger? You know, the instance that I describe in my article of how journalists at the New York Times felt that this one op-ed endangered their colleagues. I don't know. A lot of people have raised the question of, was it really danger? It's just hard to understand. So to me, that's maybe it's actually something that's uniquely American.
Well, So the reaction is what's dangerous, and the even if it's just enforcement in the private sphere right now of private business. University settings, even though those aren't really, many of them are taxpayer funded, so it's not really private. But still, even if it's in those spheres of culture, it seems to me you're down a road, right? Do you have fear? Right now, you may just have fear of losing your reputation, losing your job. I mean, there's violence. You know, these mobs that show up to protest somebody's at their business or at their home. There's the threat of that. It's not so much state sanctioned at this point, but you know, you need culture to fold in with the orthodoxy of the state in order to give rise to autocracy. And it seems like culture is ready, willing, and able. All you need is the state to green light it. So that is sort of dangerous. And we're on a path, even if we're not at the destination yet.
Well, I completely, completely agree with it. Some of the criticisms against my article were that we don't have a state that's imposing these restrictions. But it's actually, I don't think that that's necessarily, that makes a big difference. Because absolutely, the culture, a group enforces social norms. And that already creates self-censorship. You said earlier that you talked about the taxonomy of fear. And I received so many responses to this article where people, actually established academics in some of our best universities, writing to me and saying, thank you for saying what you said, because I can't say these things myself. I will be ostracized. There will be letters against me. So I think that even when it doesn't come from the state, I think we have to be aware of how culture enforces these norms. And frankly, I don't even know if you need the state to come in and enforce them. I think that it's enough that there are pretty strong social mechanisms that do it and keep everybody in line.
And I mean, another very recent example is the treatment that classics professor Joshua Katz got at Princeton after daring to write a letter expressing concern about the rest of his colleagues at Princeton signing on to this letter about racial equity policies that would be instituted at the college to give professors of color more time off just because they're professors of color, to establish a star chamber of individuals to review the research of all professors on campus to make sure there was nothing racist in their research, and so on and so forth. And he was pilloried from all sides by his colleagues, even though he has tenure and he's otherwise insulated from termination for now.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And I think that the really tricky part of it that a lot of people don't understand is how hard it is to not say to say no to signing a collective letter. Even if you don't agree with it, you're under peer pressure. You're under pressure from, you know, if a friend or colleague comes to you, why don't you sign this letter? And then you start to make these calculations. Well, what would it mean for me to say no? Will I be next? Again, I keep returning to the Pinker letter because it was just very striking to me. It was one of the few instances that were, in fact, well investigated. There was an article in the New York Times, and the reporter said that as much as he or she, I can't remember the author, but as much as the reporter tried to get to the bottom of the letter, who originated it, nobody knew. Nobody could tell, or some people maybe knew, but they refused to tell, and some of the signatories refused to comment. So that kind of tells you that people are in this place of inner conflict. Maybe they signed, but maybe they didn't sign because they really believed what the letter said, and now they don't want to talk about it because they justifiably feel ashamed. But those peer pressure mechanisms are very, very, very insidious. You can't really see them from the outside, but they're very powerful.
She is Isabella Taborowski, contributing writer at Tablet Magazine, tabletmag.com, and researcher with the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. Isabella, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Take care.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back. I'm just building on our conversation with Isabella Taborowski about the purge, and this piece I referenced from Emily Yaffe, a contributing writer at The Atlantic, about the taxonomy of fear, essentially how the purge works, the structure of it. I gave you an example yesterday of the guilt by association. Contamination by association is the phrase the author uses. The story of the sailing expedition in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, takes a picture. Everybody learns how to tie a certain knot, bowline knot. That's instrumental in sailing, as I understand it. One of them posts a picture with a smart-ass comment, and then somebody who had nothing to do with posting the picture, just along for sailing trip, without incident, loses his job over it because it's received as some sort of mocking of the Bubba Wallace noose incident and so forth. So that's one example. Another example of the taxonomy of fear, intent is irrelevant. The author gives the example of Libby Schaff, who's the rather detestable mayor of Oakland, California. By the way, this week had her house vandalized by the mob after she refused to vote to further cut the funding of the Oakland Police Department. Libby Schaff, last month, announced that ropes had been found hanging from trees around a local lake. These incidents will be investigated as a hate crime, she declared at a press conference. I want to be clear, regardless of the intentions of whoever put those nooses in our public trees, in our sacred public space here in Oakland, intentions don't matter. Mm-hmm. Intent is irrelevant. The investigation revealed the five ropes in question had nothing to do with lynching or nooses. They were homemade exercise equipment used by adults and children, put up months earlier by a black resident of Oakland, a gentleman named Victor Sengby. He explained his intent at a press conference. It was really a fun addition to the park. But that was of no interest to Libby Schaff because intentions don't matter. The purpose of the ropes did not, quote, remove nor excuse their torturous and terrorizing effects, she said. How anti-intellectual is that? You want another example of intent is irrelevant? The purge? A vegan popsicle vendor in Chicago shuts down his cart. He was going to use a push cart to sell his peachy vegan popsicle. A vegan popsicle vendor is not woke enough for the purge. Think about that. The proprietor in question said, I saw using the push cart as a viable way as a one-person entrepreneur on a shoestring budget to get started when I felt like I had been sitting on my hands waiting because the space for his storefront operation isn't ready. Why? Because, of course, he's hung up with getting through the regulatory web the city of Chicago puts in the face of business. And because he got the backlash online about culturally appropriating pushcarts that are traditionally used now by Latino food vendors, it was a great affront that he should be using a pushcart for his vegan popsicles. Intent doesn't matter. A guy trying to start a business and get by and using a vehicle that other entrepreneurs doing the same thing use. But the intent doesn't matter because, as Libby Schaff said, you can't excuse and it doesn't remove the torturous and terrorizing effects.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Rich Lowry writing in National Review about the apocryphal stories coming out of Portland with respect to federal law enforcement. There are no random arrests. As of Tuesday, there had only been 40 arrests total since the beefed up presence began around the July 4th weekend when there was intelligence that turned out to be correct of the prospect of escalating attacks on the federal courthouse. There, one of those 40 arrests, somebody who tried to burn down the courthouse. Okay. He goes through, does Lowry, the clear legal authority Homeland Security has to protect federal property, to conduct investigations on and off the property in question of offenses that may have been committed against property owned or occupied by the federal government and so forth. He goes on, there aren't rogue arrests, but are made. These aren't rogue arrests, that the ones that have been made, but they are made in keeping with all relevant procedures. The U.S. Attorney's Office has consulted on every engagement our officers are doing, explained Chris Klein, the principal deputy director of the Federal Protective Service. Acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf, of the officers in camouflage, the so-called, you know, unnamed tagged, unmarked cars in camo. Chad Wolf, these are highly trained officers who are in multi-camouflage wear because they work on the southwest border and they work in an environment that demands that. That is their everyday uniform and is completely appropriate. Customs and Border Patrol officers are deployed to Portland to respond to the current threats because the Federal Protective Service, responsible for protecting federal property, federal buildings, lacked the manpower. So they enlisted some CBP officers, and that is their everyday uniform. So sorry to rain on all the conspiracy theories that are being propagated by mayors, not just Ken Wheeler in Portland, but mayors throughout the country, as well as, of course, their Jacobin-based voters. But readily straightforward explanations that debunk the myths that have been promulgated. Speaking of debunking mythology, this brings us to our next guest. He is Chris Bedford, senior editor at The Federalist, vice chairman of Young Americans for Freedom, author of The Art of the Donald. And over at The Federalist, they've been working to fact check this column that went viral from a couple of weeks ago, How I Became a Police Abolitionist. This a piece by social justice activist and Harvard-educated lawyer Derica Purnell, which turns out to have, or she turns out to have, apparently, a lot of Joe Biden in her, a lot of Cory Booker in her, a lot of mythologizing her personal history. For more on this, welcome Chris Bedford. Chris, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, tell us how, you know, as I said, the How I Became a Police Abolitionist, this essay that she wrote that appeared in The Atlantic, got a lot of play. I remember reading it. And you all started fact-checking it. So the impetus to start fact-checking it, what you discovered and how The Atlantic has responded.
So we started to dig into it because the story of a police officer shooting a child over skipping a basketball sign-in sheet at a city recreation center in the early 2000s, which is the timeline we figured this was, seemed like it would have made national news. This was a time when the country was in a bit of turmoil. We were in one war, on a way to another war. We had a 24-hour news cycle. There was suspicion of the police state and the crackdowns that had happened. A story like this seems like it should have registered on the national scale, and if not, at least on the local scale. The fact that no one I knew had heard of it caused me to start looking into it, and we figured out her approximate age. She said she was 12 in the original article when this happened. And based on some other newspaper articles and profiles she'd done, she's done quite a few people have profiled her because she's got an interesting story. We dug in, and I started searching through first the newspapers. And then I figured we have to find where she lives. And she gives some very vivid details of her neighborhood. She says she grew up in a polluted and dangerous neighborhood in the south side of St. Louis. The problem is the details she gave didn't line up. The highway she specifically named was in the north side. The Budweiser plant that she names was 4 miles south of its closest point. But we did eventually find it because she said she lived next to a World War II or old military aircraft junkyard. That didn't seem to exist, but there was a collection, a private collection of old military planes, some of which were in disrepair, so it could be mistaken by a child for a junkyard, behind a private business in an area of town in the south side. And from there, we were able to branch out. All right, there's a chemical storage facility nearby. She describes that. It doesn't exist anymore, and that's because it exploded. So it literally was a very polluted neighborhood, at least for that period of time. From there, we were able to figure out where these potential recreation centers were who the police officer shot the child in. So we launched a records visit search for one with the police department for a three-year period, and then another one with the police department for one that was about a mile and a half away, but we wanted to make sure that maybe she and her sister hadn't walked to a different recreation center and be thorough. There was a lot of different police responses we found during those years, but none of them involved the gun, except for possibly one suicide attempt, and most of them were for arson or breaking and entering or a suspicious vehicle or kind of low-level crimes. So when we got in touch with the Atlantic and with the reporter, they were quiet. They were silent at first on this story. And the story was that this police officer killed a child and therefore we should defund the police because we must consider the victims. What we later eventually found out to be true was that it wasn't a police officer. It was a private security guard. He didn't shoot a child. He shot an adult. And it was a different year because she'd messed up the timeline. And two female police officers responded to the scene, arrested the very remorseful subject because he'd shot his friend in an argument. And then he was charged the next day. Finally, we were able to get a correction from the Atlantic about 5 or 6 days after we published our first article and then the day after, a few hours after we published our second. And they still didn't change the crux of their story. They simply enlarged it, which was amazing, to say now instead of just defund the police, we must defund private security as well.
Right, of course.
All of the basics were false.
Yeah, just to expand, right. Yeah, no, you know, right, Chris, you bring up an excellent point. Let's also defund private security. This is perfect because what we know in 2020 America is that factual correctness is not the issue, Chris. Moral correctness is. And because Derecka Purnell is morally correct about police, you getting into the weeds on facts really is a marginal, tangential issue.
We had to be really careful because I know that in this case, exactly to your point, we hear a lot of things about lived truth and lived experience, and people are called racist very easily in this atmosphere we're in right now. We wanted to be sure and not take anything for granted, not assume that there was a lie when it could have been a mistake, and a number of other things. So we gave her the benefit of the doubt on different facts being misremembered or the highway being misremembered or maybe the smell of the Budweiser plant that was a few miles away. Okay, that's in your memory, but it wasn't in your neighborhood. That's fine. But this was such a stark memory. And one of the Atlantic, which is famous traditionally for its fact-checking, didn't appear to have checked. And when we've asked repeatedly, well, did this story get fact-checked? Do any stories in the ideas section where this was published get fact-checked or just the journalism stories? Who fact-checked this story? What evidence do you have of this story? The only response we've gotten so far from the Atlantic was after they published a massive correction to the whole crux of the article because of our reporting, they demanded that we do either a large update or a correction to our articles that had called them false.
Any response from Derecka Purnell herself?
On Friday morning, after we published our first investigation on Thursday, she responded and said, "Thank you. The Atlantic has it." And by that, I assume she meant the Atlantic has the corroboration. And that was it.
Uh-huh.
And it was an interesting response from her. I can't read into any of her motivations. And I know that she was sick the week before. So I know she was a little out of it, at least by her public social media posts. She's a lawyer, and she's
Harvard
she's the
educated.
Kind of person who at least has the training.
Yeah.
Harvard educated. She has education, too, if we had if we had made a mistake or if we had slandered her, I would expect a very strong response from her.
She
just pointed us for the Atlantic, though.
Yeah, has she been retained to be a member of the New York Times editorial board yet, or is that still pending?
That promotion's got to be around the corner any moment now. She writes still for The Guardian, and I'm not sure the Atlantic hasn't indicated if she'll be allowed to write for them again.
Well, you know, per Barry Weiss's resignation letter, she, along with Jason Blair, who is just ahead of his time, they should be brought back because they're center cut for the kind of journalism that's done, even at places like The Atlantic, it would seem, based on your investigation. I'm glad you were intellectually curious and ran this down, because it is another great example of being a terrible example for journalism. And the dishonesty really actually retards the progress we can make in having discussions about public policy, including on police brutality. It's so unfortunate that they think this serves some larger purpose or that the ends justify the means, because they really set back what they're trying to do if their intentions are pure, which I'll grant them for the purposes of this conversation. And at least somebody's out there fact-checking them. So good for you and the folks at The Federalist. Christopher Bedford.
Thank you very much.
Senior editor at The Federalist, vice chairman of the Young Americans for Freedom, and the author of The Art of the Donald. Christopher Bedford, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. I just can't help the feeling I'm living a life of illusion.
Listen to podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the show. The gentleman who gave us the homage to the all-you-can-eat buffet has done it again. I think the two are connected. His most recent piece in the American Conservative, theamericanconservative.com, the pseudo-religion of the fitness industrial complex, where he writes, self-improvement becomes sort of a self-loathing, and recounts almost like Jack Tripper-like his visit to work out with his wife and one of these programs, this one called the 80-Day Obsession. It's funny stuff. With a point, he is Addison Del Mastro, assistant editor and social media manager at the American Conservative. Addison, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me on again.
So don't tell me your love of all-you-can-eat buffets and your dislike of working out are not connected. They got to be connected.
Well, you're the only person who suggested that. So,
well, you write that how individualistic workout culture is, and that is not a compliment. And this is where you sort of remark that self-improvement becomes self-loathing. Explain what you mean.
Yeah, the point I was making there, and obviously you recognize some folks didn't, but the style was purposely a little bit over the top. I thought it was funny to take something as ordinary as a workout class and expound on it in an exaggerated way, but with a point in there. And the point I made, I thought you would open with this line because it was probably the most absurd in there and the most eyeball catching. But I compared working out to social Darwinism, and the suggestion being that in some aspects of workout culture, there's sort of this view that a sort of hard-edged competitiveness, and that, you know, it doesn't matter that society as a whole has very bad incentives towards health and fitness, that one has to struggle very much against those incentives in order to get healthy. And, you know, to me, that suggests something deeper than just the need to go to the gym. It suggests that we're sick and that our individual sickness is the result of society-wide bad habits, and that you would have to think about that if you're concerned about fitness. But that, you know, that goes by the wayside in a lot of gym culture, right? I probably had 100 people on Twitter just saying, come on, bro, just lift, you know. And I think there's more to it than that.
They're sort of making your point for you. I did pick up the gym rat as a social Darwinism made flesh line. But the line I like, because it's the one I've experienced, like I do these flywheel classes, these bike classes, the cut rate inspirational cant. I mean, it's just, that's so spot on. and you describe it as the American marriage of the crassly commercial and the cheaply transcendental, one part used car salesman, one part Christian Scientist. It's exactly right. The whole like pushing you and again, those like classes that I'm in, you know, you have a score, right? And you're trying to do your personal best and you're competing against other people riding. You do the same thing all over the world virtually on a Peloton. And but the cut rate inspirational cant that's a part of that culture is just like the cut rate inspirational cant we get it from our politics.
Yeah, right. You know, and I mean, I would note that that's a kind of camaraderie. It's not, that's a different aspect from the social Darwinist competitive aspect, right?
Yes.
Workout
yes.
culture isn't one thing. But that brings to mind what a couple of the commenters said, smart comments, live in Amish country. And they said the Amish were baffled by the idea of a gym. One of them said, why would you pay money to go work somewhere? You know, maybe we can ask those guys to quit their gym and help us build our next barn. And, you know, that's the way it's done. That's how societies and people have been healthy for human history. I mean, the gym and the diet and fast food and all of these things, they all go back to the 1950s or, you know, maybe to the 1850s, to the industrial era. So, you know, the gym is not nobly standing against fast food. They sort of exist in an unhealthy symbiosis that seems to be a modern illness.
Well, it's something that like needs to become part of your routine because the point is to integrate in factory line your life as much as possible. And so the idea of physical exercise, particularly in the digital age, is something that you have to schedule. It's not something that occurs naturally during the day for many people.
Right, exactly. And I mean, you know, I've been married a couple of years. I don't have any kids yet. And I sometimes have trouble getting fitness into my schedule. I try to stay healthy, but you know, I can't imagine being a busy, busy person with a family and, you know, maybe holding down two jobs. It's difficult. And, you know, individualism is a good thing if you mean trying to cultivate good habits, but when there are serious structural obstacles and serious bad incentives pushing down against that, I think you're missing something as a matter of political analysis when you simply reduce it down to willpower and responsibility.
Yeah, right. So you're getting to the idea of like, look, you got, as you say, somebody working two jobs, he or she has to commute to work. They got kids at home. And the message they get from American culture is that if you're overweight or you're not hitting the gym three or four times a week, then you're letting yourself down and everybody else around you. You're not being your best you.
Right, exactly. And, you know, that's funny because I think Joel Osteen has a book called Be a Better You, and there you go. You know, this interesting yeah. marriage of consumerism and a variety of religion.
And well, right, and just to develop this, the idea that the industry profits, the fitness industrial complex, as you call it, profits off self-loathing, develop that a little bit more in terms of this is just meaning you get shamed into feeling like I've got to do this. Otherwise, I'm letting myself down in addition to those I love.
Yeah, you take people's natural desire to be healthy and to respect themselves and you sort of commercialize that. I mean, I could almost see a Marxist critique, you know, of the gym, which is not what I wrote here, but I bet you could write that.
Could be a PhD thesis, yeah.
I think that touches on a point I made about policy. And a bunch of the people said, oh, you know, conservatives trying to get the government to do things for them, that's not conservative. And, you know, that's not exactly what I meant. I'm thinking of policies like the Farm Bill, you know, subsidizing the ingredients that go into fast food and junk food. Repealing that Farm Bill is also a variety of policy. Or taking a look at housing and zoning policies, which result in long commutes and sedentary lifestyle. That's policy. That's the sort of thing that I'm talking about. And, you know, in an article about the gym, I haven't gotten into those terribly deeply. But there are ways to look at reforms that would make it easier for people to do the right thing in terms of fitness. I don't think it's illegitimate to use politics to improve people's incentives, and I think that's different from social engineering or from trying to outsource the hard work yourself.
He is Addison Del Mastro, assistant editor and social media manager at the American Conservative. Do check out his piece, which I will tweet out. The pseudo-religion of the fitness industrial complex. Addison, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
Take care. But I've been in the wrong place, but it must have been the right time. I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong song. I've been in the right vein, but it seems like a wrong on.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the show. Get woke, go broke. It's a saying. Is it a thing? Is that what actually happens to big corporations that get woke? In other words, abide the latest and greatest pronouncements from the cultural Marxists and incorporate them into their business operation? Well, what about the professional sports leagues? Major League Baseball had resisted going the way of the NFL, the NBA, up until this season. But yesterday's home opener for the Nats, Nationals, and the Yankees, before the national anthem, pregame, both teams took a knee along the first, you know, down the first and third base lines, and had a black cloth that was intertwined among them to honor Black Lives Matter. Oh, by the way, the idea that small BLM, Black Lives Matter, just the movement versus capital BLM, the organization, that there's a difference, and it's a difference that's more than a distinction, or that's an actual distinction? No. I mean, the way it's covered, to honor Black Lives Matter, the organization, capitals, first letter caps. Anyway, I digress. So they were kneeling, holding that black cloth, honoring Black Lives Matter, and we were treated to remarks from God, at least on Earth, Morgan Freeman.
In order to achieve effective change and create a new canvas of optimism, empathy must lead the charge. This moment signifies our charge, our brotherhood, our unity. Equality and unity cannot be until there is empathy. Today and every day, we come together as brothers, as equals, all with the same goal, to level the playing field, to change the injustices. Equality is not just a word, it's our right. Today we stand as men from 25 nations on 6 continents. Today we are one.
And then a moment of silence, and then it was get busy playing ball or get busy dying or something like that. Empathy cannot be a quality or unity without empathy. You think the Marxists are trafficking in empathy? That's a cultural comment. We're about to have an economic discussion, but I just wanted to make that point. And then after that, Tony Fauci came out and threw the worst opening pitch since that woman who was Employee of the Month for the White Sox last year, and went up into the stands and sat next to two of his friends without his mask on. Alex Berenson caught that, too. Again, I digression, but an important one, as we're being moralized to by our betters. For more on the topic of get woke, go broke, we're pleased to be joined by Vincent Herrenham. He's a law enforcement consultant, PhD candidate at the University of Cambridge. And over at Quillette.com, he did a little econometric modeling to try to answer this question of whether getting woke puts you in the poorhouse. Vincent, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Before we go to break, it just sort of set up the model that you set up to try to answer this question of whether going woke gets you broke.
Sure. So what I was looking to do was to answer a simple question, and it was whether or not a company implementing a woke policy, if it would lose them money or make them money based on the stock price. So what I did was that I took 6 companies, three companies implemented a woke policy and 3 did not. And what I did was that I compared the company stock prices across a period of time, looking at a before and after. And I wanted to see whether or not the companies that implemented a woke policy, if it had a demonstrable impact on the stock price, to the companies that did not. And so I guess we can get into the findings. What I found was that it doesn't seem like initiating a woke corporate policy actually had an effect either way.
Let's just pull back a second, though. For the companies that you looked at, I mean, one of the things that questions I had when I read the piece was looking at the various companies, Delta Airlines, Nike, Starbucks. They're different, you know, not all cultural Marxist policies generate the same public reaction and perhaps then market response. So, you know, Starbucks with trans bathrooms or their Race Together program is different than Delta Airlines discontinuing its relationship with the NRA in terms of frequent flyer programming is different than Nike's Colin Kaepernick advertising program. So how do you, you know, normalize that variable, the woke policy in particular?
So these are aggregates. So the reason why I took a multitude of companies is because you want to have a number of data points, a number of companies to measure the aggregate increase or decrease in stock prices. So we're taking all these companies together from both sides of the policy initiative. And so it has a method of or a way of normalizing the result.
When we come back, I want to get to some of the results, sort of the top line results, and then some of the more subtextual results from your modeling that are instructive and will generate more controversy and more conversation, I should say, and perhaps more research as well. We'll be right back with Vincent Heronim. He is a law enforcement consultant and PhD candidate at the University of Kansas.
Grab a good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Vincent Heronim. He is a law enforcement consultant, PhD candidate at the University of Cambridge. We were talking about his econometric model to try to answer the question, is it true that, as the aphorism goes, if you get woke, you go broke? He looked at a number of big American companies who definitely got woke and did not go broke, and he tried to assess whether or not their choices with respect to social justice-oriented policies negatively impacted their stock price, see if there's a way to measure the impact of the policy choices they made with respect to some of these politically charged issues. Vincent, the upshot, number one, the upshot is a very difficult thing to measure, as we were just sort of talking about during the break. But number two, in terms of a 95% confidence interval, did you find much of anything to indicate one way or the other?
Not at all. It seems to me that the model, or at least the results produced by the model, were bunk. I think there's a good reason for this, and it's because there's more at play here than just the corporate policy. It seems that there are other higher order factors that actually affect a company's stock price beyond just these woke policies.
Well, and right. And so the Professor Porter's six forces, right, the five forces, that's what you're talking about, just sort of what their competition is doing, what the market environment is, what tax and regulatory policy is in their industry, those sorts of things.
The market is the market. It's very volatile. And we have to keep in mind that there are billions of individual data points that are very difficult to model. So simply blindly assuming that a change in corporate policy with regard to bathrooms in the case of Starbucks or, you know, removing their NRA discount policy with regard to Delta, that will have a large effect on the share price of these companies, just is not correct.
Right. And it's interesting, though, they clearly believe or don't care whether or not it has an impact, because I guess they're making a risk assessment that it's cheaper to sort of conform on the front end than it is to battle and lose on the back end. And so it's the other thing that's going to be hard to measure is the opportunity cost of just capitulating right up front. I mean, assuming that you're not already an ideological fellow traveler, which in some of these C-suites you have ideological fellow travelers. So perhaps it's a more of a philosophical choice in addition to a transactional one. But for those who aren't philosophically attuned, it's a transactional choice. And how do you measure the opportunity cost? So I'm never going to be criticized for going along so long as the company doesn't tank or our share price doesn't tank, because I can always argue, look, if we do a public battle like this, we get boycotts and we get bad press. Now, that's going to be a medium to longer term problem in a way that just capitulating isn't.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I don't even think that these companies are taking a gamble. because I think that they understand that when it comes to the culture wars, the goal is not actually to maximize profit, as Milton Friedman would say. The goal is actually to minimize losses. And so the implementation of these policies, it comes with a tacit understanding that it is better to placate the activist left than to earn their ire and have them boycott your products or your company.
Right. And we see this playing out with some of the proposals that are being advanced in the context of the presidential election, with Joe Biden talking about being stakeholder focused rather than shareholder focused. Advances you've seen at the local level, policies that have been advanced. I wouldn't call them advances or advancements, but where you have to have, you know, so many people of different categories on your board of directors. I mean, those sorts of things, you know, they're trying to stave off some of the interventions that are eventually going to come by complying on the front end to hope that there's not more draconian mandates on the back end.
Completely accurate. So a company like Apple that sort of demonstrates your progressive bona fides does so because they want to sort of obfuscate from the fact that they have some questionable practices that they engage in various parts of the developing world. Although China is not a developing country, they of course have business dealings there with certain shops paying workers at an abysmal rate to construct these products. And so companies like Apple can get away with these questionable business practices by demonstrating their progressive bona fides. They can placate the activist left and still engage in the sort of activities that the activist left would deplore and would despise.
Right. So they can't get away with political apathy with the left, but they can get away with political antagonism to the right, it would seem. And so it's an easy choice if I'm just making a choice based on highest, best return.
Yeah, I don't know if I don't think that conservatives are actively going out and protesting these companies. I mean, it was sort of a meme that went around during the Occupy Wall Street protests, where a lot of these individuals, they sort of didn't have jobs. And so the conservatives who did have jobs, they just simply don't have the time to actively protest these companies.
And even when you had the season of the advent of the kneel downs in the NFL, and there was a significant reduction in television viewing of NFL games and thus associated revenue and so forth, that seemed to dissipate as soon as the behavior was less frequent. And so, you know, the take is that we'll endure some heat in the short term, even if it repels some of our fans, because, you know what, they'll be back.
Yeah, I don't know if that's necessarily true. I have a working hypothesis that the NFL, if it continues down the road it's going down, will no longer be a thing within the next 10 years. And I'm a massive baseball fan. I hope it's not the case for the MLB. And I don't know if, or at least I don't think, that the same principles that apply to these companies apply to Hollywood and to sports organizations, because you have to keep in mind that within these sports and Hollywood, you have an entrenched fandom, and they have a vested interest in the product that they're consuming. And so if the product deviates from what they expect, so if I watch, and I'm a massive Yankee fan, and I watch a Yankee game, and they're not playing baseball, they're engaging in politics, I won't want to watch the game. And so I turn off my television. It's not quite the same as, you know, Starbucks having an open bathroom policy and me really kind of not caring. I just want to buy a latte.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see if there's any way to suggest to identify evidence to support that, because, you know, you hear a lot of people, I'm done with the NFL, I'm done with the NBA and so on and so forth for all their politicking, as you're describing. I'm done with SportsCenter. And there's, you know, there's some evidence, like with ESPN, but again, there's a lot of variables. There's also the decoupling of the debundling of cable, and so that's really why ESPN is mainly losing audience, as a lot of cable channels are losing audience, because you pay for them in an a la carte way, and so it's not part of the bundle that doesn't exist. He is Vincent Herrenam, law enforcement consultant and PhD candidate at the University of Cambridge. Vincent, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Dan. I appreciate it as well.
Take care.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Time now for another reason why Dan Proft is single.
More so than ever in the era of COVID-19. And this really doesn't need much setup. This is sort of self-explanatory. A woman at a vitamin store wants the aisle cleared until she is done shopping for her vitamins. This is I'm just going to point out, this is a relatively large woman, too. So she's a bit intimidating, I think, to some of the other customers.
I command you, in Jesus Christ's name, to get off this aisle.
Really? Really?
They're demons. No, she's not done.
That's right.
Yeah.
Until I buy something and then I will happily leave. I rebuke you all and cast you into the lake of fire in Jesus Christ's mighty name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's get off this aisle until I can buy something. Have respect for Jesus Christ's saints.
Directing traffic.
What is wrong with people?
Where to begin?
Like, is that the way you think you're really going to get your message across?
I don't understand what is happening.
She doesn't want anybody on the aisle until she can get what she wants and leave the aisle.
Jesus Christ!
So she's rebuking everyone that enters the aisle.
Yeah. In Jesus Christ's name, because he died on the cross for her vitamins. Oh, boy. I understand these are tense times, and people a little cooped up. I understand, boy, if I'm a vitamin store business owner, too, I understand these are difficult times for my business, so I've got to indulge all sorts of insanity, whether it's local and state regulations on how I operate, when I operate, to the daffy customers that perhaps have been cooped up for a little bit too long and could use some outside interaction. It's not just the kids getting back to school to learn how to socialize and interact with one another in a productive way. It's also many of the so-called adults that are roaming around in the hinterlands. I'm happy to report after, at least according to this video I'm viewing on Twitter, after about another minute of perusing the aisle, she was able to locate her vitamins and exit the store without further incident. And boy, that's why Dan Proft is single, and that's why Dan Proft has long been a fan of social distancing before it was cool. Thank you so much for joining us on all our programs this week. Have a great weekend. Hopefully you don't run into that vitamin store woman, and we'll see you back here on Monday.
Fake news. He's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.